This is the Aftermarket Radio Network. Hey, ready to be inspired by a shop owner that came from the merger and acquisition realm? Hey, why did he choose our industry? What fresh perspectives does he have for us? From the Aftermarket Radio Network, it's Carm Capriotto, and I'm with Thomas from Hotchkiss Auto Repair, and his passion about people and training is infectious. Hey, thanks to our partners Apex and Shopware for providing this episode. You know, Apex knows the importance of the service professional, and last year, they created a dedicated space, Repair Shop HQ. Now, this area is a one-stop shop for all your service and repair needs, including technical and management classes taught by the industry's most sought-after trainers. Hey, to register, visit aapexshow.com/register. And remember to also make your hotel accommodations on the Apex website, aapexshow.com. I'm going to be there. I hope to see you there. Apex, now more than ever, November 1st through the 3rd, 2022. Hey, are you using the best innovative shop management system in the country? Are you? Think about it. Why make life harder? Shopware stays one step ahead of everyone else by listening to shops and solving problems fast. On the web at getshopware.com. Tell them Carm sent you. Hey, I'm honored to have Thomas from Hotchkiss Auto Repair in Denver, Colorado. Hello, Thomas.
Hello, good morning.
Hey, I found out about you through an article that Rob Merwin wrote. He may have said, hey, Carm, you got to interview Thomas. He's just a cool guy.
That's flattering.
And what really hit me is my God, look at, we're going to do another story about an industry outsider who has turned his business into a wonderful opportunity here.
Well, it's exciting. And, you know, running a good business is sometimes different than the trade itself. That's a trick of its own.
Thomas came from the merger and acquisitions world. And was it mostly private equity?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I started my career at JP Morgan as an investment banker doing debt capital markets. So had, whether it was corporations or municipalities, we did lots of capital raises. I did go into the mergers and acquisition world when I was at Lazard, did some private investments, I think over $10 billion and 200 transactions in my career as an advisor. So, you know, not traditional just venture capital or private equity, but a few different roles in the professional finance world.
Okay, so you know money. And so here's this individual, Thomas is looking at wanting to do something. And I think you said that you wanted to do software as a service, SaaS. That would be a really cool business to buy, but you didn't.
So that was one example. And in the time I sort of stepped away from the last investment firm, I said, I just want to buy a small business and operate it. So I actually looked at a number of different industries. SaaS, software as a service, was one. I also looked at port logistics for like shipping ports logistics and service businesses. There's a myriad of industries I looked at, and over 800 small businesses in the span of a year. Automotive definitely wasn't at the top of the list at the beginning, but by the end, I kept coming back to it for various reasons.
Why? What was the reason?
If you look at the automotive industry, there's a few characteristics of it that are quite attractive, actually. You know, the first is that it's, you know, a highly segmented industry. So you never want to enter an industry where there's three big players and you're trying to be a new player. You know, automotive is one where, yeah, there's some big national names, but so many people gravitate to that neighborhood shop because they feel like there's some honesty, there's some integrity behind it. So the fact that there was a segmented industry, that in itself is attractive. Also, there's a lot of negative public sentiment about the automotive repair industry. And to some degree, that's a good thing if you're an operator that wants to be founded on ethical behaviors, honesty, customer service, customer education. It provides an opportunity where people are walking in with their guard up and you can really make them feel at home. Their expectations are low, but then you prove that that expectation was too low. And all of a sudden you have, you know, ambassadors for your shop. Also, you know, the automotive space is not one where a lot of investment companies are looking at individual mom and pop shops. Sure, they're looking for, you know, 10 shop operators and things like that. But, you know, you don't have the competition from some of these professional investment companies. And the other last thing, which most people understand, is it's a recession-proof industry. In fact, when, you know, broader markets go sideways or even down, folks are keeping their vehicles. They're not buying new cars. They want to do repairs. So if you're an ethical shop and you're sensitive to, you know, people's pocketbook, customers are going to keep showing up to you. So there's a number of reasons why automotive repair as a non-discretionary business is one that's, you know, highly attractive in terms of its fundamental characteristics.
Well, thank you for that incredible overview. Also, perfectly right. I loved when you mentioned the Neighborhood Professional Service Center, NPSC. I came up with that acronym about 20-some years ago when I was attempting to describe the power and the value of the local. You drive out of the neighborhood and on the one of the corner lots of where your housing division is, there's going to be maybe a drugstore, maybe a gas station, maybe a McDonald's, maybe a Dunkin' Donuts. But the shop was a neighborhood place to be. And so many of the top shop operators, no matter how big they're growing, they've never lost their sense of community.
That's absolutely right. And one of the things that's really important to us is, you know, when we see a customer, we're not seeing them in their vehicle one time and we'll see them in a year. The idea is we're building a relationship with them. One of the analogies I say is when we interact with customers, don't be a bank teller. This isn't transactional. We're building relationships. We want to not only service that individual's vehicle, we want to know their children. And when their children get to high school and get their first car, we want them to come into the shop and come over to Lyft. Let me show you your vehicle. Let me tell you how to operate it. That's the type of relationship where a shop isn't just a business. It's part of the community.
I love that. I'm a big fan. Years ago, I read a book, Rethinking the Sales Force. It was by Neil Rockman, and it was all about consultative or relationship selling versus transactional, and it really changed me. I would recommend people to want to read that book and to realize. I mean, I would say that 99% of all the shop owners that I know in North America, they're all about that relationship, Thomas. So how did you end up with the place? That did you buy this from a previous owner? Did you start from scratch?
Carm, this is actually my fourth automotive business. So the first couple shops I bought, Advanced Transmission Center, still operate them with them. I had a meeting with my general manager this morning. That business was founded in 1986, Danny Moyle, and it's a transmission specialty business. So I spent my first few years in the automotive industry in a very difficult specialty. So talk about getting thrown in the deep end of the pool. Fast forward a few years, those shops are operating exceptionally well. In fact, they were the first AAA approved specialty shops in all of Colorado. And so we're really proud of that. The reputations were great. The growth was great. And I thought, you know, let's continue doing what I'm doing. And the opportunity for Hotchkiss Auto came up. David Hotchkiss, the founder and a spectacular technician, had been operating the business successfully for two decades. And he and I met and he appreciated what I had already proven in terms of my track record at the other shops. And, you know, we made a deal. I acquired it from him. He helped me in the transition. And that was a couple years ago. So really excited about what we've accomplished. But I recognize that our success today isn't just my operating ability the last couple years. It was the two decades before that that the founder built that business up.
Sure. So you bought a great growing business.
Yes. It's one of those things where when you buy a business, you have to be very cognizant about what's working. Don't come in with some preset agenda on here's the business plan and I'm going to shove it down everyone's throat. So I spent a lot of time thinking about what made this business really good over the first couple decades of its existence. Why do customers already love this business? And then moving forward, think to myself, well, what can my background, what can my strengths lend this business as being a visionary, as being someone forward thinking, and improve it rather than, you know, break down things that are already working?
He said the word visionary. How many times have we talked about that on the show? If, you know, if you're a visionary, you need to have an implementer to make sure that the levers are pulled for you. And it's tough when you have a small business and there's not many of you there. And you know you have that breakout visionary style qualities, and I'm happy for you that you were able to take your visionary skills and being able to step back from the everyday routine. That's excellent.
Sure. And I'm sure many, many of your guests want to spend more time being in a visionary and building their business. But our industry is one that, you know, unless, you know, you're a 100 shop operation, you know, every one of us owners need to spend time in the business, part of the operations. And yes, we want to build our business, but we're a people-centered business and the team members want to see you. The customers want to see you. So there's certainly an element of that that I enjoy. But it's important to realize, you know, when you're wearing a suit and you're in a high rise, your customers can be on the phone or your clients can be on the phone. But at the local neighborhood shop, they want to shake your hand. They want to know who you are.
Hey, Apex has announced a new and exciting webinar series produced by Shop Owner and Tire Review that will offer training on automotive technology and business management. See all the classes and register at aapexshow.com/webinar. Now stay ahead of the curve and don't miss these free Apex webinars that run now until September 2022. These webinars are part of a new 8-part Apex Repair Shop HQ series that will provide essential takeaways on ADAS and alignment diagnostics, hiring and retaining employees, no-code drivability diagnostic strategies, service advisor customer satisfaction strategies, navigating the rapids ahead, and start-stop system diagnostics. Each 45-minute webinar is recorded so you can share it with your team. See a complete list and attend any or all webinars. Simply register at aapexshow.com/webinar. You got to stay ahead of the curve, and you know that. Don't miss the next free Apex webinar. Register now, aapexshow.com/webinar. Hey, if you run more than one shop, you know how vital it is to keep up with how each one is performing, but it can drive you crazy to log in and out of each shop's database as you try to compare KPIs. Well, stop making it hard. With Shopware's advanced analytics, you can easily pull all the data into one report. Heck, you can even set up the system to pump it out in a graph or a chart, then email it to you anytime you want it. Why tax your brain before you even start looking for trends and wins to celebrate? Let the computer do all the work for you. Spend less time sifting through pages of numbers. Now, once you've seen your business's potential right in front of you, you can take steps to make it even better. Now, then you can take the night off to enjoy the time you just won back. Benefit. And go with the team that created DVX. My friends at GetShopware.com. So let's go back to the next acquisition that you're going to make, Thomas, and I'm just throwing this thing as imaginary up on the wall. Would you look for another very successful business, or would you say, hey, you know, that used to be a shop over there. It's closed and it didn't have a good rep, but I really love the location.
Working in hypotheticals, it's a fun exercise, but the reality is that each opportunity is going to be unique. Am I open to, you know, there's that shop that's been shut down on the corner for X, Y, and Z reason, but it has great bones. Maybe the property itself, the real estate's up for sale. So there's an opportunity there. As a lot of business owners know, that combination of property plus business is powerful. You know, maybe there's a great neighborhood. Maybe it's a neighborhood where the incomes are going up and all of a sudden there's not a good shop within a few miles. It's certainly something that I would do. Now, I will say it is very difficult to take on a business and do a turnaround versus stepping into a successful business and say, hey, don't screw this up. Listen, be quiet, be steady. And then as time goes on, make the incremental adjustments that lead to transformational impact over time.
So many of the MSOs, multi-shop operators that have grown lately want to buy a successful business and slowly lead and implement, you know, all the good things that are going on with theirs into theirs. But, you know, one of the things you said was bones, and sometimes culture is a good bone to have. Pay a premium for it. If you can make the numbers work, you'll get your money back in 5 or 6 years.
I don't disagree with that at all. And there's a key element there. When you buy a business, you know, yes, you're buying a brand. Yes, you're buying a reputation. But the most important asset that you're really acquiring is, are the employees, that customer base. It's people. It always comes back to people for me. So if you acquire a business that might be around for 10 or 15 years, and there's a number of people within that business that have been employed by that business, maybe the business even went sideways, but if they're quality folks that have great teamwork, then you can instill some professionalism, instill some marketing, get some more customers to the door. Now you're allowing that team to reach its potential. There's so many parts of the equation that have to come together. On the other hand, if you're just buying a building, well, you better hope the culture that your other operations, your other shops have is strong enough that a new building with new people can take on that culture. You can lend that culture to it. But, you know, it's a lot easier to talk about than it is to execute. So I'm very envious and proud of seeing a lot of shop owners transition from the, I have two or three shops to the five or six shops. That's another big jump that becomes very challenging.
Yeah, that is scale, no doubt. Oof. So you have the two transmission shops and this mechanical shop called Hotchkiss, right?
Yes, sir.
So you entered this industry not knowing a whole heck of a lot about it and all the levers. In fact, just before we turned on the recorder, you said, it's a fun business, but it's tough if you're not paying attention. You had said to me, Carm, if I came in arrogant, I wouldn't have learned a thing. And I had to hang out with some guys that knew their stuff. So I went and I think you joined a business development group.
I did a couple of years ago, joined a business development group. And the great thing about that, it's not every owner is cookie cutter. Some come from business backgrounds, maybe as engineers, maybe doing more of a 9-to-5 sales role. Others came from growing up as technicians, becoming owners, becoming multi-shop owners. And then there's people like me that, you know, I'm kind of one of the young ones in the group that just entered this industry about 4 years ago, where a lot has happened in a short amount of time. But, you know, the depth of my knowledge base is very different than some of my colleagues that have been in this for 5 decades.
Can you remember back what was your biggest takeaway and you walked away scratching your head and says, that only makes sense. Wow, that's great.
As someone that spent a lot of time advising board of directors and being in big corporate America, for me, it was always thinking about sophisticated business strategy. It was thinking about KPIs, key performance indices, right? It was thinking numbers. It was thinking strategy. It was thinking what McKinsey, Bain, and these, you know, sophisticated strategy houses are doing. And the biggest takeaway for me in spending time in the businesses and with my peers is probably the third time in this interview that I'm going to mention it. It's all about people. That's the element that you don't go to school for that. You don't need a degree for it. If you can't be empathetic to people, customers, your employees, their personal situations, having an emotional intelligence, emotional IQ, that to me is the absolute key in being able to be a great operator.
I spent some time in corporate America, about 10 years. I can so empathize with what you just said about the people thing. And I'm not saying that it was good or bad. I'm just saying that there's a chance that certain leadership forget about the power of people.
And it's challenging for, in this industry in particular, you have a lot of shop owners who maybe they're multi-generational shop owners, right? Their father and their grandfather had the shop. So they've always known ownership or being part of ownership or family of ownership. On the other hand, a lot of owners, they've been the owner for 10 years or 15 years. And oftentimes it's a single person or a brother. And the challenge there is, where's the accountability for the ownership? There's no board of directors. There's just the owner. And everyone else is sometimes thought of as just part of their universe. And that's why I take a step back and ask, you know, if we can have more of a flat leadership structure, if owners listened more, yes, the owners are married to the business and the employees may not be, but give employees and team members an opportunity to feel at home in the shop, to feel like they can make decisions, to feel like their concerns are heard and they're having an impact on the workplace. When that happens, all of a sudden you have a team of people that are no longer just your employees, they're your colleagues. And that is a very different feeling because people want to feel empowered. People want to feel value. And if all they're feeling is, you know, just being the employee of someone else, or I'm the person that's helping that guy buy his second car or second home, then the value in their day, their self of their sense of accomplishment, I think is diminished.
Work with me on this whole feedback thing that you just kind of brought up. Are you reaching out to your team? Are you making sure that you're present with them? Do they know that they have, you have an open door policy? They have your email, they have your text. How does that up and down the ladder in a very flat environment work?
Sure. And so it's constant in our organization. You know, one thing we do at Hotchkiss Auto is that, you know, we do monthly meetings. I meet with every single individual at the end of every month. And we talk about not only their production, but we're talking about what do they think are some things that didn't go well in the month? What are some things that did go well? And I try to hold them accountable to what did you say you were going to do from your personal and professional development? Are you doing your end of the bargain? What can I do to help you champion being the best version of yourself? What can I do to help this organization better? Right. So it's creating that dialogue that allows people to express positive and negative. Oftentimes people just want to be heard. And so that's one thing that is important to me, having those dialogues. This past weekend on Saturday, I went to an all-day training session with the technicians from my transmission shops. I mean, it was for technicians. It was for transmission rebuilders. What am I doing there? But the key for them is me understanding that I'm showing up, spending my Saturday with them so I could understand the complexity of what they're doing. And that was one of the first things one of the guys said to me. It's like, I'm happy you're here so you can see what our struggle is. I'm like, absolutely. I can't manage if I don't have a sense of, you know, what our difficulties are. And I want them to understand that, you know, the empathy that I talk about isn't just hollow. You know, I want to be there. I want to understand.
It's such a great point, Thomas. You made me think about the wife and the husband. Even though maybe the wife isn't involved in the business, she goes to a few seminars that he goes to and sits right next to him and starts to hear a business coach or a trainer talk about people and culture. And, you know, she's constantly hitting him on the arm. they do that when they listen to my shows too, right? And they're saying, wow, that hit home. That it's easier to sell. Thomas, when your people come to you and says, hey, you remember that training session we were at? We need this tool because of this valve body and this thing over here. And you'll say, guys, you're right. But, you know, just got to ask. This is great. I see. You don't have to sell me because I was there. What I continue to hear so much from people is exactly what you said, that the owners continue to participate in training, no matter what level it is. They may not go, like you said, they may go 4 hours and just kind of be there. But that they're involved with their people in training. And their people also know that they're going to training on their very own for leadership and management, like you said, EQ and stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's one of the reasons I went out and got my ASC certification for a C1. It's not because, you know, I guess I am an automotive professional, but in a different way. You know, continuous development starts with humility. And when an owner is training, it's an acknowledgement that they are saying they don't know everything. And, you know, if you can't instill a culture of training and development, then how is the brand going to actually develop if the people aren't developing? And I think that's also, there's a lot of jobs out there that can pay high hourly rates. And some of the people in the automotive industry are like, wait, why don't I go be, you know, loading trucks for Amazon? Well, the training and development component is what differentiates a job from a career. And what our industry needs to be really focused on is providing career tracking for the people in our industry rather than just jobs.
You know, I always love it when guests come on and they just kind of land these huge statements in my lap. I recently did an episode with my great friend Matt Fonslow, who's on the network. He's got his own show. And we did one on career tracking and basically resume keeping. And it was a great episode. And near the end of the episode, I kind of outlined what I thought a technician on his very own should keep in a training resume of his and what every owner should keep in a training resume for his peoples. When someone comes to work for a shop and he says, well, what training have you had? And they produce or they link the document that they have online to all the training that they've had, who the trainer was, what venue it was, did he pay or not pay, the details of it, not just the name of the seminar, but into the details of the who, what, when, where, why, and how.
Absolutely. You know, in my organization, there wasn't a lot of training in the past. And so when I started talking training, they just thought to themselves, okay, he just wants us to get ASE certifications just because that'll prove we're master techs. And that wasn't it. I said, I don't care if you have certifications or not. What I care is that you've created a habit in your professional and personal life to better yourself. Last month, we sent a couple of our top techs at Hotchkiss for 5 days to Orlando for industry training. And no one in our shop has ever crossed the border for training, much less went for 5 days, was paid for their time. And they came back saying, Thomas, you have to go to this next one. And I said, absolutely, I'll be there on the next one.
Do you know what Vision KC is?
I've heard of it. I haven't had an opportunity to go myself.
There's nothing like Vision KC.
Sure. And I feel like I'm a toddler in this industry and I'm just getting to know some of the players locally and in starting to think about nationally, well, what is this industry doing? How can this industry transform? And certainly these are the conferences and opportunities that I'd like to get to and, you know, learn and listen to speakers and contribute where I can to make this industry better.
As you look around, what do you see? You see a trend at all?
I mean, there are some trends, right? There's a few things going on that are both opportunistic and also problematic. One issue that's a challenge is just the level of talent in our industry and the level of talent entering the industry. At the point where every shop is begging for an A-tech, or a lot of the top techs are just hopping from one shop to the next, you know, you're losing that ability for teams to work together over multiple years and being able to create a chemistry and solve problems, not just as one technician in one bay fixing one car. But that collaboration that old school shops would have really, you know, maybe one person's doing the repairs, but it's a team of thinkers that are collaborating together. And I feel like the industry, unfortunately, is losing that teamwork as we're seeing more turnover. We're seeing less people develop through their automotive technical careers from being C techs to B techs to A techs. And that what that creates is a lot of labor inflation and competition for talent. And so that's one of the reasons why creating a lot of culture inside the shop is really important, because you need to retain talent, not just because someone's going to produce, but because your team is going to be better as a collective whole than the sum of the individual parts. So that's one big problem in terms of the talent coming in this industry and the ability of shops to retain their talent. There's other things as well. I mean, we can talk about how M&A has impacted this industry as well. There's a lot of national brands that have gotten bigger and bigger and bigger, some because of, you know, whatever their investors have mandated, others because private equities become interested. And what that's created is bigger buyers outside of, say, dealerships. And it's making the one shop mom and pop's location have less buying power. All of a sudden, their relative pricing against X, Y, and Z national brands is disadvantaged. If we're buying exactly the same part and mom and pops is buying it for 30% more expensive than the brand name down the street, then how are they going to stay competitive and have a sufficient profitability so that they can make sure they're raising wages for their technicians that are getting calls from everyone under the sun, as well as, and we're talking technicians, it's a problem of our industry as well. What about that front office staff? What about those service writers? What about those service managers? Are they getting the training? Are they getting the development? So we have this trend towards these brand names. And what we talked about at the beginning of our conversation is that the neighborhood shop is losing its wings. It's losing its power. It's losing its influence. And that becomes very dangerous for the industry, because the bigger the brands, the more shops there are, the more it's about profitability. And I'm not saying profitability is bad. I'm a capitalist. But my view is, if you operate well, you operate ethically, you operate in a sophisticated fashion, the profitability will take care of itself.
One of the things you talked about was career opportunities. I'm struggling with something. I'm struggling with A, B, and C ratings. And I'm not necessarily sure if we were going to bring people in and show them a career pathway that we want to label it C, B, or A, because there are some outstanding mechanical technicians that because they don't do diag, they're not called an A, when they're really at the top of their craft. They could do brake jobs and timing and engine removals blindfolded and beat the clock every day because they're so good. They're machines, and I don't mean in a negative way. And so why wouldn't they be a mechanical A tech, and why couldn't there be a diagnostic A tech? You think I'm thinking right here?
Valid criticism. And this is where sometimes you accept certain industry lingo, but then you recognize maybe it's not ideal. My use of those terms is almost because they're habitual and it's an easy way to categorize. And it's always, when you think about, you know, talking to a C tech or a B tech, traditionally what I'm encouraging them is, how do we create some sort of guide and pathway for you to become an A tech or a master tech? But the key is, there's no monolith. You could have five different A techs in a room, and they're very different technicians and what they can do and how they perform. And the key is just understanding that if you're a C tech or a B tech, then that means there's probably some material room for improvement and career tracking. But if I sit with my A techs and we talk a lot about their development. And yesterday I was interviewing a guy who has been wrenching for 43 years. And the bulk of our conversation was, where do you want to train? Where do you want to develop? How do you continue to move forward? How do you stay hungry? So I think there's a fair criticism in that ABC designation. But the key for every shop is just asking, how does a particular candidate and their capability fit within your shop, within its need? And at the same time, asking that candidate, where do you want to be? Do you want to be a diagnostician? Do you want to be a shop foreman? Do you want to be the person that just flags a ton of hours? These are different roles within a shop. And I think that's where it's really important to understand who that candidate is and what their potentials are and what their strengths are, and play to those strengths.
You are so right, spot on, that individually people have, they have different needs, but they also have different capabilities. And if he wants to bill a lot of hours, come on, I got a slot for that. Don't tell me that you don't want to train, because we all train here. This part of our culture. But to find the niche, if you will, that works for an individual. They're not all, well, here's my technician crew, here's my service advisor crew. They're not all the same. One may do tires so well that the one who doesn't do tires so well says, listen, I'd like to introduce you to Sally here, because she knows all about the kind of rubber you need on your car. What, and if we don't have individual goals, and it's team goals, then everyone's willing to help each other out.
We alluded to earlier some of the turnover in this industry. If you have a real team, 4, 5, 6 guys, if your shop's big enough to accommodate that, well, do you need all six of those technicians to be hybrid specialists? We're coming to an age where that's a big topic, but maybe not all six need to go spend a week doing training. Maybe that one of the folks there, they really want to do it. So you invest in them, you encourage them to do it, they become hybrid specialists. What about if someone else doesn't want anything to do with Volkswagen and Audis? But then, you know, they want to be the master tech in Subaru, Toyota, you know, Honda. That's great. And that's where that team element comes in, where you're all playing to different strengths and different interests. And, you know, no, the master tech doesn't know everything about everything. They're really great at a few things, and that's why you might consider them a master tech. But don't give them an Audi. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Another great point is that we were doing one of our aftermarket weekly shop tours, and there was this box on the floor and this beautiful cabinet in, if you will, a training room. And I said, what's all that stuff? He says, well, those are all the books from the training that our technicians have attended. And I said, what's in the box there? He says, well, we hired a new technician, and he's bringing his training materials to put in our library. So you go back to the training resume, and, you know, Thomas, your business grows. Now you've got 50, 60 people working for you, and you're picking a vision or a strategy. We're going to work on Euro or Asian. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. You go down your training resume because you're smart enough to keep it. And you look at someone, maybe you need a backup hybrid specialist. Well, you're looking at the person who hasn't attended hybrid training in 2 years. Maybe we should send them again and send them along with someone else who wanted to raise their hand and say, I want to be on that track too.
Right. I think one of the keys in all these things we're talking about is too often training is not defined or doesn't have direction. And the key is once you create these libraries, once you say, you know, here's what you want to get good at, let's create a pathway for you to do that. It might include certifications. It might include, you know, individual, you know, recorded training. It might be in person, whatever it might be, create a pathway so that there's some sense of transparency. And you can also hold each other accountable, both ownership and leadership, management of a shop, as well as the individual. And when you do that, other people, maybe those that are less motivated to train or do development, they're going to see that. One of the teams I train with talks a lot about is motivation cannot come from external sources. It has to be internal. And if that individual has some internal motivation, but that fire hasn't been caught yet, all of a sudden, seeing someone else develop, progress, get recognition for that is going to make that internal motivation really fire up.
It is the truth. Just because it's a sunny day isn't going to motivate you to do the next thing. Someone telling you, or at least giving you that high five, or giving you an accolade that you're doing so great, continues to get you continue to do what you feel good about. And if your people don't feel good about coming to work, they're not going to give you a good day.
Everyone wants to be, we're social beings, right? When you break down the industry, when you break down what we're doing, at the end of the day, we're social human beings and we want to be part of something positive. We want to feel like we're winning. And far too often, shops don't have a winning culture, a team culture. You don't do that just by having some revenue numbers or having some flag numbers. You have this sense of community. You have this sense of we're in this together. And when you can have numerous levers of success, whether that's training and development, whether that's acknowledging people's, you know, anniversaries, whether that's supporting people even when they have their downtime, there's something really great about when if someone's having a rough time and all of a sudden the entire shop comes to their support. I'll tell you, that shop has a lot better retention than a neighboring shop then.
So are you a tweaker? Do you tinker with processes and systems as you, you know, sniff them out and see, hey, is this still working?
Yes and no. I mean, on one hand, it's almost like you have to do some of that. But on the other hand, people are very uncomfortable with change. And I've realized that over the years of the assumption is if something's changing, it's either to their detriment, or it was just a haphazard type of thing. So what I like to be is very transparent about what we're trying to change. For example, you know, the parts management process is one that we, you know, completely revamped in the last 6 months to a year. And there was conversation to an exhaustive level about it, to the point where they're like, can we stop talking about it and just institute these changes already? So at that point, rushing to make change is one that makes people uncomfortable. But when there's constant conversation about it, then at least they know it's coming. And when it does come, they're finally receptive to it. So I think it's important to adjust processes, question processes. You know, one of the things I say in the businesses all the time, there is no sacred cows, right? We can do things different. Just because the industry has done things a certain way, its entire career, there's no reason why we can change. For example, one of the things that we do that's pretty different than, you know, other places in the industry is all three of the shops that I have the pleasure to operate, not one technician is on flat rate. I don't believe in it, at least at this stage. But I know that's a minority view in this industry.
There's less flat rate out there. I almost think it's 60-40.
I think there's a trend to that, Carmen, and some of it comes back down to, you know, what works well for a shop. So if there's plenty of shops out there, it works fine. So I don't think fundamentally it's evil because it works at a lot of places and both the technicians, ownership, management like it. But on the other hand, you know, if I may criticize it, you know, there's something that flat rate does that it communicates to a technician that they're an independent contractor. You are here for production. Your compensation at the end of the week or month or whatever it might be is directly tied to your production level. And my view is that, yes, production should be an absolute huge part of the formula of their total compensation. But if for any reason business was slow 1 week, but that person showed up and they were there, great team player, helping others, cleaning up, maybe doing training, helping with the shop, I want them to know that come payday, they have a paycheck coming that'll help take care of their bills, their lives, their livelihood, because they did their part in showing up. And if customers didn't show up, hey, that's a management problem. That's a marketing problem. I want to make sure that some of the things I've heard in this industry, and this may not be at the top shops, but in other shops, you know, conversations about this technician got the gravy and this technician got all the hard diags and this technician got, you know, this, or this service writer doesn't like me and they're, you know, not selling enough hours. Those are conversations that can become very toxic quickly. And I know the top shops particularly find ways around that. They manage around that. They create checks and balances. But it's just not something that I want to, you know, risk our culture on.
So well said. I am going to put a pin on that and ask you to come back, because that was a great way to end this first episode with you about the toxicity that could reign inside of a business if you're not careful. Thomas from Hotchiss Auto Repair in Denver, Colorado, you will come back?
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me, Carl.
Thanks. Honored to have you, man.
Thanks for being on board to listen and learn from the premier automotive aftermarket podcast. Until next time.